Power 102 brings In Focus all day today, empowering you.
And good afternoon, I'm Andy Johnson, standing in to the program today. This is State of the Nation, but we're doing In Focus. We're continuing that discussion. This segment is from now until 2 o'clock. We have a lot to get through. We hope to get through all of that. Afra Raymond, evaluator, is in with us. Clyde Weatherhead will join us. Joseph Remy will join us. And David Abdullah will join us between now and 2 o'clock. Mr. Raymond is in with us. We'll start with looking at the year that was almost and what to look for in 2019. Good afternoon.
Hi, Andy. Good afternoon. You know, being interviewed by you is always a special thrill because there are few interviewers I'm nervous about, and you're the one.
Really?
So once again, it's very good to be at Power 102. And to be here with you and sharing my views with the listeners and so on this important issue, kind of wrapping up
2018.
So it's good to be invited, and thanks again.
Well, thanks for coming. Yeah. And in your case, I mean, there was a big moment for you in 2018. Well, you could tell us which is the second one, about taking the state to court, as it were, on the question of providing information on this huge Sandals deal, and the court saying that, in fact, you had a right, and you operating as a person in representing the people of Trinidad and Tobago.
Yes.
The information should have been made public.
Yes. Well, Andy, I wanted to say to you that point that you highlighted is very important, but it was his second victory in that trend. The Sandals MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding that the government signed on our behalf for the Tobago Sandals is intended to be constructed at a Golden Grove Buku, no man's land, was signed on the 10th of October last year. And of course it's non-binding, and it sets out the intentions of the parties. And it's a very unique moment, because while at the same time we're trying to look back over a 12-month period, which is the function of the show and our exchanges, it's also important to locate it in a larger context. It's unique because we have a large-scale development that is being planned within, let us be frank, the usual conditions of secrecy. And I have been able, by a very focused effort, to get the publication of the MOU before any concrete has been poured.
Yeah.
According to Dr. Rowley in Parliament on Wednesday, the 12th of December, which is last week, Wednesday, a week ago, nothing has been signed. We're a long way away from anything being signed. According to the statement from the Chief Secretary of the Tobago House of Assembly, Mr. Kelvin Charles, that he released yesterday, obviously in response to our meeting in Scarborough on Thursday, nothing has been signed. So then I want to say to them, and I'm taking the opportunity on your show, Andy, gentlemen, that is marvelous news. If nothing has been signed, well, then we could be discussing everything again. Because certainly there are parts of that agreement that are deeply detrimental to this country. And then that discussion needs to be reopened now, if not sooner.
So what was the issue about that, if nothing was signed? And if, you know, the government was...
What they were saying, the MOU was signed, Andy, on the 10th of October last year. What the government has been saying, and Mr. Chief Secretary, Mr. Kelvin Charles, and Dr. Rowley has been saying, is that no further agreements have been signed, no further binding agreements have been signed, and that matters are still in discussion. And the position I am taking is that if matters are still in discussion, given how detrimental the clauses of the MOU are, there is time and space for us to address those detriments, and also the actual question of whether the project should take place at all.
At all.
You see, those are fundamental questions that are now up for discussion, given that nothing has been signed.
And
nothing binding.
Yeah. But Mr. Young in particular, mm-hmm. he was leading the charge sort of in opposition to your activism on the matter.
Yes.
They were putting up resistance on the basis that, well, this is a sensitive thing, mm-hmm. and we can't release the information.
Yes.
And was it a fact that to what extent that was substantial? When Mr. Adam Stewart said to reporters in Antigua or somewhere, that, well, we have no issue with wanting to keep anything secret.
Well, I think Andy, that's a very pertinent point you're raising. I think they were blowing hot and cold on it. Was it a secret? Was it not really a secret? Both sides, the government and the Sandals people, were blowing hot and cold on it. The point is that when you look at the clauses of the MOU, and I'll go into that in a little while, when you look at the clauses in the MOU, you can understand why there was this tremendous ambivalence about it. Because what it is, as far as I could see, is that the country has actually, I don't want to say committed itself, the country has noted its intention to spend our money to build this large-scale resort. I think the permission they applied for is for 925 rooms.
Yeah.
The MOU mentions about 820 rooms. The country has applied for permission. The country has applied for permission to build 925 rooms at our expense.
So Mr. Butch is Stewart, that an issue in itself? That,
of course it is. Mr. Butch Stewart and Sanders are not spending any money. Yeah. No, not plus. It's one of the two.
Yeah, things, right. Yeah?
But Mr. Butch Stewart and Sanders aren't spending any money. Even the money that they're spending in design fees, because they're designing the resort to their specifications, even that money, if this project doesn't proceed for any reason, the government is supposed to refund that money to them. So even that, even those relatively minor expenses are not being placed at risk by Sanders. The only money being placed at risk is our money. And there's nothing wrong if you look at the history of point leases, or indeed the big investments in our country, the big game-changing investments in the country. There's nothing wrong with the state taking a role as a risk-taker in transforming the economy. Where you go further is that, in fact, having agreed to spend the money to put up the resort, we appear to have agreed to grant tax concessions, duty concessions, and work permit concessions to Sandals. So one has to ask the question, if you have a tax concession and you have a duty concession and you have a work permit concession, so there's no guarantee of employment, and you have concessions in respect of procurement, the acquisition of goods and services, that they can decide who they want to give those contracts to, what's in it for Trinidad and Tobago? Why should we spend $3 billion in a situation where the intentions set out in the MOU don't have any clarity as to how we're going to get a return on that money? So it's a terrible agreement. I'm delighted that both of those senior officials have confirmed that the thing has not been agreed, that no further contracts have been signed, and that matters are up for discussion. Well, great, let's discuss
it. What does it say, though, overall, that 3 years into, because we came into this administration with at the top of somebody's list very early, that nothing is signed 3 years later? Nothing substantive has been signed?
Well, it remains to be seen what is and isn't signed. I think that my experience in these things tells me that these things take a long time. They weren't able to do anything in terms of actually operationalize the conversation Dr. Rowley had with Mr. Butsua. They weren't able to operationalize that till they won the election in September of 2015. And they started to operationalize it with certain things. They put up certain groups and working parties and so on. And these things will take a long time in conversation. I'd be surprised, Andy, if in fact the only thing that's signed is the MOU. I think they may have advanced along the road. Obviously, people like Rowley, Dr. Rowley, the Prime Minister, or Mr. Kelvin Charles, who's the head of the THA, may not actually be the persons signing those agreements, because if they're binding contracts, permanent secretaries and so will sign them, or state enterprises will sign them. But certainly, I'd be surprised if we're not further along the road.
But so what? You suggesting that we're not being told the whole truth then? If people are saying that nothing.
Well, we have had a hot and cold breeze blowing all the way through this, and as I'm saying, if it is indeed that nothing has been signed that's binding the country, that's very, very good news, because we can reopen this thing for discussion. Another aspect of the thing that concerns me, Andy, and it ought to concern every citizen, is that throughout this matter, the names of very eminent citizens have been invoked as having been involved. So, for example, on the 30th of June of 2016, the cabinet announced the appointment of a negotiating team that was chaired by former Finance Minister Wendell Motley. Dr. Terence Farrell was on that committee. Dr. Rolf Balgobin was on that committee.
On this matter?
Yep. So the cabinet appointed a negotiating team. I'm just remembering three prominent names of eminent people. A little while passes, we know Dr. Farrell resigned from the Economic Development Board. We also know Mr. Motley stood down from his public appointments at the end of May this year. But in a little while, about 18 months ago, we started hearing about a cabinet-appointed negotiating team with my friend, another former finance minister, Conrad Enel, Mr. Wilfred Espinay, who is now the chairman of Petrotrin, and other people.
So the composition of the team has changed.
Yes, but the point I'm making is that what has been invoked along the way officially has been the names of very eminent people as having been involved in these negotiations. We also have the Tobago Tourism Agency, which has replaced the TDC, and that is chaired by Dr. Sherma Roberts, who's an eminent person at the UWE Cave Hill, dealing with tourism, the master's program in tourism. And I'm asking the question, did all these eminent people sign off on this deal? It's a terrible deal. Are those conditions, terms and conditions that they approved? Because it's something the country needs to know. Is it really that we agreed to spend $3 billion in a context where we have transfer pricing arrangements in place to minimize the tax standards pays? We have a management contract in place where they can put subsidiary companies along the way to take to suck money out as they see fit, which is the purpose of transfer pricing. We have no guarantees of employment. We have no guarantees of local supplies. And is that the best we could have done?
At this point, mm-hmm. there is no guarantee mm-hmm. that this deal will go through.
No, there's no guarantee, no.
At this point, what is your feeling about? So this administration has 2 years to go before the next general election. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you see over the next 2 years as to how this matter progressed?
I'm not a sightseer, but I would expect that there would be efforts to push the project. A lot of political capital has been sunk into it from the level of Dr. Rowley come down. People have stood behind it and spoken loudly in support of it. And the kind of way that we play our political sports in this space, it's kind of rare that somebody having committed this amount of political capital to bet on this horse would actually back down and say, well, and I think Dr. Rowley, there's a statement I remember from him saying that in fact only the courts would stop the project. So he appeared to be, from the tone of that statement, to be quite committed to the advancement of the project. We would see, you know, I guess we would see as it unfolds.
No, there are significant people mm-hmm. in Tobago representing significant interests
yes.
who aren't as sanguine about it either. But to some extent, they're being, as with everybody else who even has questions about it, are being painted in a certain kind of way.
Yes, that is happening. There's a certain kind of, I guess I could use that phrase, bite up. A certain kind of bite up commentary is taking place. And that's unfortunate because it's an important matter. And it's almost irregardless of who's in power. Because, in fact, yes, the PNM is in power and Dr. Rowley is the Prime Minister elected at the moment and so on. But this project is so long term, and it's a 25-year contract as proposed with an option to renew for a further 15 years. So irregardless of the current personalities at the table, we have to exercise a little more responsibility and leadership and look beyond the 2020 election and beyond who's in power on the other side and so on, because it's going to be sitting with us for 40 years. You know? It's going to be sitting with us for 40 years.
Yeah. All right, we need to take a break. We need to do some news headlines and we'll come back. This is In Focus, mm-hmm. 2018, the year on the way out, inside of State of the Nation for today. We'll be back. Stay with us.
In Focus. In Focus. On Power 102. Empowering you.
All right, welcome back to the program. We're joined now by David Abdullah, former trade unionist and leader of the Movement for Social Justice. Afro Raymond is with us. David, welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Andy, and all the listeners on 102.
Yeah, you said you were following the discussion on the way here. So we're talking in the main about the standards. Is that an issue that we're talking about the big events in 2018. Was that one for you?
I mean, yes, I had raised questions about sandals, and I was glad that Afro did pursue on his own the freedom of information request to get the MOU. I've had a very quick look at it, and one of the issues, of course, is quite apart from the matters that Afro was raising, is the lack of commitment to workers and labor, in the sense that Sandals can in fact use workers from anywhere. There's no obligation to employ people in Trinidad and more particularly in Tobago. And so that the whole work permit arrangement under law could be circumvented by this MOU, apparently.
Yeah, but how would something like that come about? Why was that a feature of this original preliminary agreement?
Precisely, why would the government think of signing on to something like that? Because there is, under the CARICOM single market economy, there is free movement of labor of certain categories within the region, and we accept that and support that and so on. So, there is a work permit system in place. So why speak about Sandals' absolute right almost to hire whomsoever they choose? Because you can't have an absolute right to do that if there's in place a law that says you can't.
Yeah.
That you have to go through a work permit process. So that is a major issue. And Sandals has a very bad track record of industrial relations in the Bahamas. There was a union there that sought to get recognition at Sandals. They got recognition. Sandals refused to accept the recognition, and the union challenged it all the way to the Privy Council and won the right to recognize and represent the workers there. When they then sought to have that implemented, Sandals dismissed all the workers and hired new workers who obviously would not have been part of the union. So there'll be major issues in St. Lucia with respect to the issue of withholding taxes. And the former Prime Minister Kenny Anthony had to issue a statement about the fact that Sandals was trying to get him as Minister of Finance to get the Board of Inland Revenue in St. Lucia to absolve Sandals of its obligations of withholding taxes. He had indicated when he was in office as Prime Minister, Minister of Finance, that is not the responsibility or not within the authority of the Minister of Finance, that is solely within the remit of the Board of Inland Revenue, which has independent responsibility for taxes and collection of taxes and so on. But subsequent to the loss of the elections by the St. Lucia Labour Party, Sandals has now gotten the withholding taxes reduced or eliminated or whatever. In Antigua, the Prime Minister of Antigua, Gaston Brown, has been making complaints about Sandals in Antigua. So there are major issues about Sandals' behavior in CARICOM countries. Now, it therefore is the responsibility of the government to ensure that whatever agreement is arrived at is an agreement that does not give Sandals disproportionate power and wealth deriving from that power. In other words, and I think I've raised the question, what is in it for Trinidad and Tobago, exactly, and the people of Trinidad and Tobago?
Exactly.
Because we as taxpayers are putting out that money. So you had no money to put out to pay the bullet payment of PetroTrin, $850 million. But you have money to put out for Sandals. After I hear you say $3 billion.
$3 billion is an estimate.
Other people have estimated more than that when you add on not only the room costs but the additional costs and so on.
The own costs.
Of golf course and et cetera. So we don't know where that final cost is going to end up.
Yeah.
But that is taxpayers' investment. So there must be now a rate of return. Where does the government obtain its rate of return for that money that is going to be spent?
All right, so there are a couple of things. One is the idea that there are enough lessons with Sandals' presence in the Caribbean alone for us to learn from. It doesn't seem that, you know, the decision makers are taking those things on board. And the other one is to what extent the concerns that you all are raising may be sort of presupposing the idea that you all may be against the deal altogether, or that there could be arrangements that are put in place to the satisfaction of people like yourselves who have these concerns.
I think that you can put in place proper arrangements to ensure that Sandals get some benefit, obviously, though they're not putting out any money. So therefore, you know, the benefit that Sandals should get purely is management contract rights and so on, and some financial consideration for their brand.
Yeah.
Right? That is what they should get. The investor, which is government of Trinidad and Tobago, namely taxpayers, needs to get a return on investment like any other investor would expect to get. So you have to put in place the proper arrangements. And we haven't even dealt now with the issue of the location of the project, which is another major issue.
And there are major concerns,
about that. So it is not that you are against Sandals per se or anything like that, or that we should have tourism development in Tobago. That's not the issue. The issue always is with respect to the terms and conditions under which these arrangements take place.
Well, yeah, your take on that.
Well, three quick points. The first one is that the whole model of tourism, which is the point David closed on, the question about being against Sandals or for Sandals, is not actually Sandals' model, that large or inclusive model, is not actually spoken to strongly in terms of our national tourism policy. You see, we have to root these proposals in policy. There's a researched national tourism policy of 2010. And that policy actually speaks strongly to Tobago and Trinidad being a place because of our unique cultural offerings. Our unique offering isn't white beaches. We are a place with a vibrant, diverse culture, a vibrant and diverse flora and fauna, and we end up niching a spot where a white sand beach was being marketed. That's how inappropriate it is. I'm using appropriate language because I'm on the radio. It's totally inappropriate. It flies in the face of the policy. And once again, we're finding a vast sum of public money being found to invest in something that in fact sits contrary to, and I'm saying it here clearly for people who want to understand, contrary to the existing tourism policy in this country.
Yeah,
it's a research position. Second point in terms of the location is that in fact, given that our country has signed an international convention, the Ramsar Convention, in relation to the preservation of wetlands, we are signatory to three such conventions in our country, and this and the site is one of them. The site of this proposed development is one of them. It certainly is a very offensive proposal that we are putting forward here. I focus in a particular way in what it is I've been doing in relation to the underlying commercial terms, but it's as offensive as somebody rationalizing 20 years from now or 30 years from now when us old fogies are no longer around, but somebody sitting around a radio station or this or an internet station or whatever they have and rationalizing building apartment blocks in the savannah because after all, people need place to live, right?
It's as foolish as that.
It's as foolhardy as that. Okay, and thirdly, so we talked about the approach in terms of the resort proposal. We talked about the location. And thirdly, I want to talk about risk management because it's something that I have not brought out. I brought it out in my talk in Tobago and in my essay published today. But let's put that on the table for discussion.
Uh-huh.
One of the important features of the Antigua and Barbuda episode with Prime Minister Gaston Browne is that when Prime Minister Gaston Browne tried to bring Sandals to order in relation to the taxes that they weren't paying, they were withholding taxes and pocketing them. When he tried to bring them to order, they threatened the government of Antigua and Barbuda, effectively pressured them by closing the resort for 5 months.
Yeah.
Now, let's be clear. Let's conduct a clear-eyed analysis of what happened there. In Antigua and Barbuda, the money to build the resort was spent by Sandals. They put out the money, possibly in the hundreds of millions of dollars, to put up that resort. Yet, when they were put into a position where they had to pay the correct taxes applicable by law, by the elected government, they were ready, willing, and able to put a gun to the government's head and say, if you don't stop that talk, we're going to close down. Now, we now know the amount of money owed was $101 million EC dollars. It was $39 million US dollars for a tiny country like Antigua and Barbuda. We now know that Prime Minister Gaston Browne did a lovely speech on YouTube, 30th of June 2017. He explains the whole thing an hour and 10 minutes long. We now know that Browne and them were forced to come to the negotiating table and to sign away the $101 million EC dollars for a $1 thing. And Sandals admitted no liability because of the pressure of the 5 months threatened closure. Mm. Here my point. So over here we discuss this. In Tobago, under the current proposal as outlined in the MOU and as outlined in the many official statements from both Sandals and our own government, Sandals not putting out any money. We put in out all the money. So if the Antigua and Barbuda government could be pressured by a hotelier who's ready, willing, and able to close, the instant they see something resembling pressure, they don't like it. These financial implications. We are far more exposed
in terms of
risk analysis. Yeah. We are, Trinidad and Tobago is far more exposed because they've put out no money.
Yeah.
It's nothing for them to have the lights. And say, you know, sometimes we're closing there for 9 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you'll call me back when you're ready.
And the dynamics wouldn't change because in this case, they didn't put out the money, so they may not be able to play as hard a ball.
Nobody
as
could close the place. Suppose they say, well, they don't like it. They have a problem with vermin or they have something in the swamp. They're not sure with the fresh salad and with the fruit salad and the mango thing, and they have to close. And they haven't assigned us to check something, and until
have we been told, in terms of
risk analysis, our national interest is
they have no money jumping in, investment.
Skin in the game.
So
we need to get a bigger analysis than this.
Can we ask inside of that? How was it arrived that the government of Trinidad and Tobago, the people of Trinidad and Tobago, would put the money up rather than?
Well, I suppose they were following the model of the Hilton
I think the Prime Minister said that,
and the Hyatt, you know, those buildings. Hilton, which is, became Magdalena, yes, and so on, was built.
Yes.
So they're probably going with that model. So assuming that you're going with that model, you now have to present some kind of information. Because I don't think we have ever been presented with an analysis of, say, the Hyatt is more recent. The Hilton, of course, has been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. What has been the return on the investment for the Hyatt?
Yes.
And therefore, obviously, the Hyatt gets management fees and so on. We know that the majority of people there are, in fact, employed and are nationals, etc., at all levels. But it would be very good for us to get analysis on what has been the rate of return to the country for the Hyatt.
Yes.
And it might very well be positive.
Yeah.
But the cost of the Hyatt is minuscule compared to the cost of
for this proposed standards.
Because you're talking about between 700 and, I don't know, 900 rooms.
Yes, 900. Two resorts
course,
and a golf course and
25 restaurants.
It's a completely different scale. Plus, we have to do work on the airport, which may be necessary in any case, but this is obviously a key conditionality, if you wish, unwritten in the project. So you have to now look at what is going to be the cost benefit.
For wetlands protection and those kinds of things.
What is the cost-benefit analysis of this project? And these are the things that one is not hearing about. And that is what the government should be able to come to the country and present a cost-benefit analysis. And if it shows that it is very positive, then we will have to say, assuming that the figures are right and so on, we'd have to say, okay, well, this may make good economic or financial sense. And at the point that I was making about some people being named to the original negotiating team,
yes,
I don't know if all of them actually ever were functioned
co-opted
as were members,
and
or whether they were invited and
was
named.
I don't know. That's all I could say.
I'm not sure if they all actually
attended any meetings.
I don't know. To participate in that process, and one will have to ask those honourable gentlemen.
That's what I'm asking.
Whether they did or not.
Yeah, all right. I know that they may be. I know there certainly is with you, David. A lot of other issues in the docket as it comes to 2018.
Yeah, sure.
What about in your case, Afra? What was big enough?
Well,
be talking about
the other big issue which I touched on for about 2 seconds when we started off, Andy, is that at the beginning of the year I also had a freedom of information victory in relation to the CL financial bailout.
Yes,
because with the 9-day memory and the torrent of events in our life, we could forget these things. The CL financial bailout cost the country about $26 billion in public money. It started off in January of 2009 with the collapse of the CL financial empire. And really, there has not been any accounting of how that money has been spent. I've been after three things. I've been after the accounts of CL Financial, audited accounts. I want proper accounts. The same accounts you want for MTS and Solid Waste, I want those for the $26 billion in CL Financial. Okay? I haven't been able to get those up to now. The court case awarded some things to me, but they haven't been given. And the other thing I wanted is to get details. Well, the Ministry of Finance, having offered the figures on their feet in court in January 24th of 2018, is now saying they can't find the papers and so on and so on. So we have a situation where it's very, very serious. And we're going back to court. We're going back to court on the 23rd of January next year to press for this. So the other point, Andy, is, of course, details of how that money was spent. Apart from the accounts, which is a structure for how money is laid out within a company, we need to get details of all the payments. If it is, we can get details from the Digger Martin Regional Corporation or the Kuva Tabaki Talparo Regional Corporation, how much money was spent on box drains and which contractor got the contract and which contractor fixed a retaining wall down to the penny. And we have all understood that, well, all of us who are working in the public life, we all understand that for many years. Why can't we get the details of this $26 billion?
And when it is necessary, whichever side is in the majority in the parliament, when it is necessary, information finds its way into somebody's hands in the parliament and it is read out in the parliament, usually as an attack against somebody.
Yes.
Well, you see, because both governments presided over the expenditure of that money to giving that money to CL Financial. I say giving.
Yes.
They were giving it. So both of them now, I suppose, have a vested interest in people not knowing exactly how that money was expended.
And why is it that we have to employ these means like you do and other people do, to have to spend money to go to court for an administration to release information in the public interest.
What I was able to get in January as a result of the concession by the Ministry of Finance 24th of January this year was that they actually released information about the EFPA. So in fact, the Ministry of Finance through the Chief State Solicitor released to me the names and the amounts and the details of everybody who was paid under the EFPA, 13,200 names, $10.823 billion was released in that thing. The mystery is, having released that on the 24th of January, they had a high-power team led by Mr. Russell Martin, former
Attorney General,
former President of the Law Association. It wasn't a team of juniors. It was led by one of the most eminent lawyers in the Caribbean.
And he didn't do it for free.
That was the position that was taken informally in court. I then applied to the Ministry of Finance to get the information about the rest of the money, because it's 26 that they spent. We only have details about 10.
Yeah.
And I've now been going through 9 months of obfuscation about they can't tell me this, they can't tell me that, and they're afraid of the fear of crime and security and so on. And that's why we're going back to court in January.
Yeah.
Because I intend to get all the details of all the payments, of how our money was spent. It cannot be good enough that we have details about box drains and retaining walls and school feeding. But when fat cats are being paid out, $26 billion, we have an air of mystery and a fear of crime. The economic crime has to stop. Social and economic justice is a must. And that information is going to be part of my target on the 23rd of January in the High Court here in Motorsport.
I'm going to link that, David, to something that I heard on another program this morning, another segment of the program this morning, with people talking about injustice in society, to say that the justice system tends to favor those with resources and those people higher up the social chain. And I'm thinking about it in the sense that there are many issues crying out for answers and for information in the society, but only some of us who can afford it, who can bear the cost, whether or not when the decision is delivered, they say, well, the loser has to pay cost. But people who have what it takes to challenge the system by going to court in the first place.
I mean, Afro is lucky, he has a little bit of means to be able to go to court. He has a little bit of means to go to court. But the majority of people, Public interest. So there are several levels. There's public interest matters, which is what AFRA is pursuing.
Yes.
And there are a number of other people. Mr. Reginald Dumas has pursued some, and there are other people who pursue some. Sure. Some are done sometimes pro bono by attorneys who feel this was an important issue to pursue, and so on.
Yeah.
Then there are other matters between, say, in civil matters between firms and individuals, that you feel you are wronged by an insurance company or by whatever, and so on. And those firms can afford, you know, top lawyers, and the ordinary person who has a problem can't. And yes, if you don't have good attorneys, your chances of you winning is much less than if you have good attorneys. And the best attorneys do come at a higher price. Mm-hmm. So people are disadvantaged in that way. And then, of course, if you have to rely on the system of legal aid, there's a shortage of legal aid attorneys, and the fees paid to legal aid attorneys is small, and so on. And therefore, when you get to the criminal justice system now, if you're charged for a criminal offense and you don't have access to a good lawyer, you can't get legal aid attorneys to assist you, then you can be in serious trouble.
Yeah.
So money and wealth does play a role in terms of access to justice, and the justice system, and your ability to succeed in the system because of those imbalances. And that one of the things that has to be strengthened, therefore, is the legal aid system, to ensure that there are public defenders or persons in the legal aid system who can defend, who could defend everyone.
Yeah, and Charles, we have a commentary to do.
I think I'm
all right. Well, let's take a break.